Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. It is 12:11 here in Chicago. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's Friday. That means Blue Sky is in town from the Chicago Tribune. I don't know why I'm struggling over that so much, John. Blue Sky Innovation from the Chicago Tribune. John Carpenter joins us every Friday to talk about that. And it seems like every Friday, John, when we talk about Blue Sky, we talk about Groupon in one way or another.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, if you're the CEO of a company and you write a memo or a blog post and part of it is making it clear to everybody that you're not going out of business, you know that, right. You know, you've taken over a tough job and you know, the Groupon CEO is basically the Groupon stock has been plunging. It's been plunging for a while, and I think it's at an all-time low.
It was plunging, and then once Rich Williams was named CEO, it plunged even more.
Right, right. I think people have just sort of lost confidence in the company. They expanded really fast, and you know, this he wrote a blog post, and it was probably a good thing to do. You know, it's always helpful to see how the new person views the world, and he made it clear that they probably expanded too fast, but he also sort of laid claim to a future where they expect to kind of dominate local advertising or local marketing, which, you know, remains to be seen. But obviously, the stock market is pretty skeptical. I mean, the stock is like a couple of dollars.
A quote from that memo. And while I'm shaking things up, I assure you that I am not crazy.
Yeah, right, right. I mean, you know, here's the thing to remember. I mean, Groupon may be the poster child for a missed opportunity. I mean, they turned down an acquisition offer of $6
billion. That's right, yeah.
And I can remember at the time thinking, like a lot of people, okay, Groupon is a really great company, but $6 billion is kind of something that no matter how bright your future is, you kind of have to say yes to, right? And they said no, and I'm guessing that a lot of people are regretting that.
I've been regretting it ever since, probably.
Yeah.
Tell me about this idea, because and I'm not sure I understand that he says that it's still possible to win big in local business.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's the intersection of my business, which is the newspaper business. I mean, it used to be in the world of advertising that when you wanted to target locally, you advertised in newspapers. That's, you know, the local readership. That's why you see car ads and all kinds of things. And that obviously has gone away because it's so easy to target locally. Not just locally, you can target individually on the internet. And Groupon, I think, because, you know, for those of people who don't know, Groupon is the place where you can get, you know, coupon deals, online coupon deals for local restaurants. Great idea if you're a small business looking to kind of drive a little business to your way. And so because their network expands out into these small businesses, I think they saw themselves as sort of the heir to becoming the dominant place for local. And the reality is there probably isn't a dominant place for local. It's the internet.
It just cannot be.
Yeah, yeah. And well, because you don't need a, you know, if you're a marketer, you don't really care if you're on Groupon or the Chicago Tribune or Yahoo or CNN. What you care about is that you're reaching Steve Bertrand and people like him,
right,
or John Carpenter, and you're able to do that on
or
the
maybe
internet.
You're reaching 6'5" right-handed, you know,
right,
white men
who make X amount and who recently shopped for a car and who, you know, recently visited X website. I mean, that's what the metrics of the internet allow you to do. They allow you to, you know, if you're L.L. Bean, we've all seen it. If you're L.L. Bean and you shop on L.L. Bean for half an hour but don't buy anything, guess what? For another 2 or 3 days, you're going to see a lot of ads for L.L. Bean because they're following you around saying, hey, come on, we know you looked at us for half an hour. Come back.
Yeah, I was actually worn down by one of those not too long ago.
Yeah, right.
And I was worn down by them.
Well, I think what they're hoping for is, you know, you looked at that pair of boots, but you didn't quite pull the trigger on them. But then guess what? You go on Facebook the next day and there they are. And you're like, you know what? Those do look nice. I'm going to go back and buy them.
There's another piece in Blue Sky Innovation about hugging in the workplace.
Right. I love this story.
I do too. I love this story. When is it appropriate and when it is not?
Yeah. You know, we kind of asked around, and I think it came down a little bit on the side of yes, it's appropriate.
It's a tough thing.
Yeah, well, you know, especially in the startup world, which we cover, you have a lot of growing small companies with really passionate, enthusiastic CEOs who I'm guessing, you know, no scientific research here, but tend to be sort of huggers and high fivers.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I think, you know, some people can pull it off. Some people who love to hug can kind of pull it off because they have this big, larger-than-life personality. Me, personally, I'm a little bit more reserved, and I also like to think that I'm maybe cautiously respectful of other people, because some people it makes them uncomfortable.
Well, the story starts with Dori McWhorter, who's the CEO of YWCA in metropolitan Chicago. She's a big hugger.
And right.
One of her quotes is, "I do think we need to stop acting like we're robots," which is nice. But let's say, I mean, I know women who've complained about male bosses who touch them.
Right. Right.
Hug them or whatever. So it's easier for Dori maybe to give a hug than.
Yeah. Like I said, yeah, some people have that personality. And but even if I had that personality, I think I would be kind of wary and I would be respectful. I mean, just like, you know.
Which is too bad. And maybe that's what the article's about. In a way, it's too bad, because then we are acting like robots. And you do, if you are of a huggable sort,
right?
You know, you benefit from that human contact.
I think. Well, but there's a fine line between acting like a robot and being respectful of people's personal space. I mean, you can be enthusiastic and emotive and you know, demonstrating your affection for somebody as a colleague without hugging them if you perceive that they're a person who doesn't really like to be hugged.
Right. It's like so many issues where we are right now where. You can be acting in a perfectly natural and, in your mind, respectable way,
right?
And get in trouble because it's not respectable or considered such by someone else.
Yeah, and people, you know, people do perceive things in different ways. You know, I mean, years ago I used to work in a company, and one of the elder statesmen of the company used to have a button that said "Kissing Zone" on it,
you know,
and he was an old guy who liked to kiss girls, and it was so ragingly inappropriate, and yet it was he didn't mean anything by
Absolutely.
It, but I mean he had to be kind of dialed back.
Well, since I know now that you're not a hugging sort, I won't give you a hug today.
All right,
but it is your last day on this program.
Yeah,
it's your last day with the Tribune.
Right.
You're leaving to do other things. And I mean, it's sort of you're living a business story in many ways. We've read in the Tribune and elsewhere about the buyouts, that people are taking buyouts. And you've elected to go on to bigger and better things, or better things at any rate.
Well, let's hope so.
So I've enjoyed talking to you. And I'm going to throw it to Beyonce here for traffic. And then I'm going to give you a big hug.
All right. Well, thanks. And I've really enjoyed being here. This is a great show. And it's always nice to talk about these things.
You made us smarter, John. Thank you for that. And I know you will, too, in other ways. So.
All right.
We'll keep in touch. John Carpenter from Blue Sky Innovation in the Tribune. It's 12:23 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, 720 WGN. As I said, Tom Gimbel is here, the founder, CEO of LaSalle Network. And usually we find a way to talk about sports when you're here, Tom. You always work in a sports angle. But tell me about this idea of competition, because as I'm no manager, right?
Right.
And so... When I think, I mean, I can see the benefits of competition, but sometimes there could be a scary side to it, too.
Well, I think when people hear competitive, they think, well, wait a second. I'm a doer. I like to get things done. That's a person who's cutthroat and going to hurt me.
Right. Well, that's what it is, isn't it? So sometimes
it's perception.
When you hear competitive, you think of tearing someone else down rather than building yourself
or
up.
Or being torn down.
Or being.
And I think that's probably more of the issue, which you think, wait, if I'm competitive, I have to tear somebody else down or somebody's going to tear me down. And I think I won't get into sports as much as we usually do, but it's a great analogy. Who wouldn't want to be a starter? Right.
Right,
you practice as hard as you can to be on the first line or to be a starter. And sometimes the coach has to say, hey, you're better coming off the bench or in the second line. Doesn't mean you stop being competitive to want to be in that position. And you try to figure out where you fit. And in the workplace, a manager wants people who want to be given the best projects, who wants to have the tightest deadlines. I was just reading an excerpt from Michael Bloomberg being interviewed, the former mayor of New York and obviously creator of Bloomberg Terminals. And he said, you want to give work to the person that's got the most on their plate, because there's a reason they have the most on their plate.
Interesting.
They get it done.
Right.
Right.
So if someone's got, hey, I've got some free time over here.
You
got
to wonder, why are they not going out and asking for it more often? Why are people not delegating work to them? Because maybe they're not as competent. You want people who want to be the alpha dog, if you will.
But you also want to bring those others, the non-alpha dogs, along, right? And if you ignore them, that could be to your and their peril.
Yeah, I think where people get lost in the competitive nature is it's up to good managers to be coaching staff along the way and say, here's the issue. You do really good work, but if you don't voice that you want more, if you don't voice that you want to be better, I say in my shop, and I talk with clients that I consult with, I'll always say, we want people who want to race to 100, and they want to get there first, and they want everyone else to get to 99. And I think what a lot of people think is the race is to 100, and I have to want to get to 100, and I want everyone else to be at 60.
Right.
Right? And that's not – that's unhealthy competition.
So how can you – how does being competitive with someone – teach you? How does it make you better?
Well, I think you've got the biggest thing that we want to have is self-perspective. And so you want people to realize that you're being competitive, but how you're communicating with other people in the office is really what's going to reflect on how you're viewed. And so you might get something done, but if you've cut down your peers along the way, you've won the battle, but you're going to lose the war because the company is going to have turnover as a result. And if the company has turnover, you're not going to get another project to tackle. There's actually going to be downsizing.
Right. And, you know, until I started thinking of this, I didn't really consider what I thought of when I heard the word competitive. And as we sort of exercise it and stretch it out, I hear it more negatively because I do hear it as, she's so competitive or he's so competitive, meaning that they are tearing down other people,
right,
or that they want to shine above for not necessarily the better reasons.
Yeah, I think that the ideal thing, I mean, even working at a radio station, you want salespeople who are competitive, and it's not necessarily internally to be the best salesperson here, but they want to beat out the other radio stations to get those advertising sponsors.
So if there was one thing a manager could do to foster competitiveness in the workplace, what would she do?
I'd say you want to create contests where there's rewards.
Really?
Yeah, I think contests, whatever, however old
that's
we
a
are,
very sales thing, isn't
I think it?
It
is, but I think it can be done in accounting, it can be done in operations, it can be done in human resources, is reward people with contests for accomplishing things and also for inclusiveness. And then I think surveys are way overdone. However, I was just talking to my marketing team today, and they came back and they said that they actually surveyed people on how they view the marketing department.
They how people within the marketing,
marketing
right.
internally at my company, yeah. The marketing department surveyed people to find out just what the perception of marketing was. And it was a little bit aloof, not as outgoing, right? They're so
right.
focused on what
and
they
And so the managers done. Take that and do what with it?
So then she said, okay, listen, here's the goal for everybody. And whoever gets the most coffees or lunches with internal staff, right?
Uh-huh.
You win X.
That's Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. Tell me about LaSalle a little bit so people
Thanks.
Understand.
Thanks. I appreciate the plug, Steve. So we're a 160-person recruiting and staffing firm. Majority of our business is in Chicago, but we do searches all over the country. Human resources, accounting, finance, technology, call centers, administrative.
That's no plug. That's sharing information. People hear a smart guy like you, they want to know. Can't wait for the next time.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Tom Gimbel on the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is a Friday afternoon, which means in most office buildings, happy hour has already started. Scott Kleinberg is here from the Chicago Tribune. He writes about social media. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
Let's start about, well, maybe we could start with those office happy hours where Bob meets Mary, they fall in love, they become a pair, and then eventually they break up.
Ah, hate when that happens.
And they were Facebook friends, and they followed each other's every movement through Facebook, but now Bob can't stand the sight of Mary, and Mary is a little afraid of Bob.
Sounds
How
like
do
movie.
They separate themselves? Because, right, Facebook, the way it's set up, you can, even if, and I'm going to say stalking, but I don't mean it to be such a moment of danger, but you can, you know, cyber stalk these people, find out everything about them. So how do you express a little distance without defriending them? That's something Facebook is taking up.
Yes, you rely on Facebook's new things that they're testing, new toys that they're testing, and they're going to make it so if you change your relationship status to say that you are no longer with someone, you're going to get the option to untag yourself or to change the visibility of past posts with that person or totally get rid of yourself in a tag on a photo so other people can't see it.
So like I'm sure that it says on my Facebook page that I'm married.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it says that I'm married to Sharon Bertrand, but that's what we're talking about, right? You would with a relationship, you declare with whom you're in the relationship.
Exactly, yes. But I think in this case, even if you didn't necessarily declare it, you could declare it, but it may not be public. So even if it's not visible, they would still give you the option to say, you know, I don't want this photo showing, you know, my tag
right.
or that kind of thing. When I first saw it, I thought it seems like something Facebook should have had all along. Perhaps somebody inside Facebook had this happen to them and they were like, you know what, maybe we need to develop this. It just hit me that maybe that's how it happened.
As a parent of a high schooler, and as we talk about it, I'm thinking, I think my son might declare that I'm his husband so that he can split with me and then filter what I see on Facebook.
Boy, you know, if it works that way, Facebook has other problems.
It would work that way, wouldn't it?
It could work that way. In theory, that's what it would be supposed to do. Yes.
So you could be like, Dad, you're my friend on Facebook, but he could be keeping... Because you can't do that now currently. Can you keep people from seeing things?
No, you can create custom lists and you can make it so you only share it with certain people, but they would have to go through a lot to exclude you from
right.
a particular post.
Until they marry me.
And, yes.
I want to talk about what's going on with iPads too, because anytime something breaks here in the radio station and you bring in the engineers, the first thing they say is, what did you do?
Yes.
Without fail.
Right.
And then they say, well, did you try to turn it on and turn it off again, or turn it off and turn it back on?
Yeah.
iPad is having some trouble. They're like going to a black screen after a battery charge.
Yeah.
And that's what they're telling people, turn it off and turn it back
on. That's what they're telling people. And that's the thing. This is the official Apple fix as of right now. Does not mean that they're not going to come out with another one.
You don't need a genius bar for that one.
No, no, you don't. And the thing that is just so crazy about this, Steve, is this is the new iPad Pro. This is the thing that just came out that they've been testing for months, if not years. They've been so excited about. And the problem that's causing this is when someone charges their iPad, and when it's done charging and they go to unplug their charger, it is the iPad is unresponsive. So that means that when this thing went through all of this testing, that means that someone didn't charge it and then check it.
That's wild.
That is crazy because it's happening to a lot of people. I mean, it's all over the internet.
So I have the new iPhone 6 Giant.
6S Plus.
6S Plus.
Okay. Right, that would be that. Yeah.
Which, you know, people joke that is a small iPad, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, but really, I wonder, why do people have... I mean, do people still carry around iPads like they did at the very beginning?
Oh, I don't know. No, iPad usage has definitely gone down. I mean, just looking at where I work and just, you know, people accessing content from the Chicago Tribune, tablet usage is way down. And, you know, we absolutely attribute it to that because I had an iPad and I still do, but it's basically sitting in my drawer because once I got the big phone, like one you're talking about, I mean, it is very much like a small iPad. I mean, if you read a lot of magazines and a lot of books, then yeah, that little bit of screen real estate will help. But this is so close in general, and it's so much easier to carry around than an iPad.
We spend a lot of time on this program talking about Oak Brook-based McDonald's, you know, and they're always trying to fire things up, breakfast all day. Now they need sort of a jump start. Things haven't been going so well from them. Sure. So now there is this sushi chef.
Yeah. Yeah, that story's great.
Who's created a Big Mac sushi.
Yes.
Now, I think of sushi as being uncooked fish, but that's a pretty incomplete definition, I guess.
It has to be. And, you know, I am not someone who likes sushi, but this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. This guy has a YouTube video show, and he has like 40 million views, and he's this master sushi chef artist. And he took a Big Mac, he took it apart, he took all of the pieces, and he rolled it into sushi, and then he added this spicy wasabi mayo and microgreens, and he turned it into this beautiful work of art. And the thing is, instead of rice, it has pieces of the bun, and the base is the French fries. I mean, he did everything. And, you know, you look at him taking apart this Big Mac, and you think, ew, that doesn't look very, very appetizing.
Right.
And then he's putting it into sushi, and it's beautiful. And if you look on YouTube, when you just search Big Mac sushi, you'll find it everywhere. Everybody's
talking
about
it. His show is called Will It Sushi?
Yes.
So he tries
yes.
to find different things and sushi them up.
Yeah. And this particular one is 14 minutes long, and you do not want to stop watching it. It's so cool.
So do you charge more for the Big Mac then once it's sushi?
Well, yeah, of course. And that's, you know, it's the beauty that you can do that.
Scott Kleinberg walked in here a few minutes before he was supposed to come on. And, you know, I kid him a lot of times because of his fondness for emojis. And love. But Scott, he just has this great enthusiasm. And he walks in today and he says, who brought the lava lamps in?
That's exactly how I said it.
So Wendy Snyder, and when I'm sitting in for Bill in a little bit, we're going to have the CEO of Lava Lamps. So the studio is sort of filled with different sorts of lava lamps. And so what did you do with that? You didn't make sushi out of them.
No, the first thing I did was start Snapchatting them. I always talk about how you can use Snapchat to take photos that you don't share anywhere else. Don't put on Facebook, don't put on Twitter. And I just walked around, took three different photos and put them on Snapchat with, you know, it's just a fun way to do it.
And Snapchat is now making it easier to sort of chat about the pictures as you see them, or what are the changes there?
Yeah, this is really cool. So a story is when you post something and you see all the photos in succession. But before this, all you could do was just look through the photos. Now you can chat on each one. So if you're friends with someone on Snapchat and you see their story and the photo comes up, there's a little thing at the bottom that says chat. So you can actually talk with the person about the photo.
Like live message?
Okay. Yeah. The only way to do it before was to watch it and then send them a message and then they could write you back later, and that's fine. But now when you're seeing something and you want to react to it, just like you would on Instagram or somewhere else, you want to leave a caption or some sort of thing.
But they're very short, aren't they?
I mean, they should be short, and they're supposed to be read quickly, but it's better than having nothing at all, which is how it was before. They gave you no option.
All right, so we'll check out – actually, I have a Snapchat account, so I'll –
Good.
I'll have to follow you and check out the lava lamps on Snapchat.
That would be great. I look forward to it.
Scott Kleinberg from the Chicago Tribune. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good, Steve.
It is 12:45. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We'll go golfing right after this. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here, alongside Matt McAtee, the CEO of Green Golf Partners. McAtee, did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So when this started, we were going to talk about what a warm and balmy November it was and how good things were for golf in this area. And, I don't know, Matt, if you know, but it's supposed to snow tomorrow.
I do know.
So we might have teed up for the last time this year.
There might be some diehards out today pounding their tees in with a hammer.
Sort of like the surfers right ahead of the hurricane.
Exactly.
But it has been a good November.
Yeah,
right?
it's been an unbelievable November. And, in our business, the weather has a significant impact, obviously. It's outdoors, recreation. This November with the warm weather has been a benefit to everybody. You know, the golfers, most of all, they get outside, they get a lot of exercise, they get a little enjoyment before the snow.
Right.
We all know, me as a city dweller, there's not a lot of outside activity once the snow starts falling. So it's been great.
Tell me about Green Golf Partners. What courses do you represent?
Green Golf Partners is a Midwest-based management company. We've got 18 golf courses in five states, a variety of public, private, resort. We have courses in the Southeast and the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
The Southeast is much more appealing this time of year. I'd like to be there today, as I was telling you.
Well, you're
earlier.
Not going to get out now.
No. And we manage just north of $23 million in revenues, 700 employees, great little company.
So I'm fascinated with you. I live in Deerfield, and I used to golf from time to time at the Highland Park Country Club, right? And so I'm reading that there are a lot of golf courses that are being repurposed now, that maybe there were too many courses for the golfers. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
What happened?
Well, there was a period of unprecedented growth.
Was it a Tiger Woods thing?
You know, Tiger, I don't know if it was. In the early 90s, the National Golf Foundation released a report that said, as an industry, if we opened a golf course a day for a decade, we could not meet the demand. And the developers really took that to heart. As you know, the American dream for a golfer is to live on the seventh fairway of their favorite golf course.
Right. Even people who don't golf want to live on a golf course.
Even people who don't want to golf want to live on golf courses. We built a tremendous amount of golf courses. Michigan, our friendly neighbor to the north, led the charge. They had a couple of years where they, as a state, they opened north of 800 golf courses a year. So in the United States, we've got about 28 million golfers. The projection was to go somewhere to around 50 million golfers.
It just didn't happen.
It did not happen, and for a number of reasons. One, the industry as a whole was based on the boomers. And the boomers, they were not really big fans of cell phones and music and kids and seeing their wives on the golf course. So, I don't really believe we evolved.
Oh, interesting.
And then I think, the recession. Anytime there's an impact on discretionary spending, golf feels it.
So I use the word repurposing, but we're shrinking a little bit, right?
We are. We've been shrinking since 08.
Things better now?
Things are better now.
and the future looks better as we're now just driving a smaller car.
Yeah, I mean, I think the, you know, in my opinion, the future is bright. I mean, it's a great sport. You've got a probably the biggest corporate commitment that we've ever had. KPMG is an example, you know, just a really super company has committed funds to the Ladies PGA Championship, a very big commitment. We're hosting it, by the way, 2018 Kemper Lakes Golf Club. Junior golf levels are at the highest. Kerry Williams, who was the IJGA director here in Illinois, now she's the IPGA director, did a fabulous job. The levels are incredible. The kids are flowing into the game. You know, you brought up Tiger Woods earlier.
Right.
I think the guys that are going to have the impact, I see it every day, is Rory and Ricky and Jordan.
It's huge. It is so. I told you off the air, I golf two or three times a year and swear every time I do, you know, that I'm never going to do it again because I'm just not good at it. And then on Sunday, I sit with tears in my eyes as, you know, we see these stories, the
Jason Day,
who wins in Wisconsin.
Yeah,
you know, you see these different sort of these young guys, and there's a crop of them. There's not one. There's a real crop of them. So interesting. So maybe in 10 years or so, we're going to hear another forecast that you need to build a golf course a day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are more. I see more orange in golf today because of Ricky Fowler. Every time I go to Dick's Sporting Goods with my kids, they do the custom fit joke from the Ricky Fowler ad. I mean, that's where it's at. I mean, skiing went that route. Tennis went that route. I had a really good friend that was in the fishing industry, Bill Cullerton, who told me 25 years ago that fishing was going to die if the outdoor activity was going to die if the parents didn't get their kids into it. And one thing that I just love is I see a lot of non-golfer parents now that have golfer kids.
Yeah, we know Bill Cullerton well here. He was the host of The Great Outdoors.
Yeah.
On WGN Radio, and I used to do news for him for decades. So
yeah, one of the great guys all time in the outdoors, and I wish my dad would have sent me to Costa Rica when I was in high school to learn to speak Spanish.
Mac McEntee, the CEO of Green Golf Partners. Put your clubs away, and we'll talk to you again next spring.
That sounds great. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.